and a light shower of wasted arrows fell on the green barley shoots in the field. As a military force were hopeless, Jack thought, only the wall can save us. He had a stone in one hand, and in the other he held a sling just like the one he had used as a boy to shoot ducks for his dinner. He wondered whether his aim was still good. He realized he was gripping his weapons as hard as he could, and he forced himself to relax his hold. Stones were effective against ducks, but they seemed appallingly feeble against the armored men on big horses, who were thundering closer every second. He swallowed dryly. Some of the enemy had bows and burning arrows, he saw, and a moment later he realized that the men with bows were heading for the stone walls and the others for the earth ramparts. That meant William had decided he could not storm the stone wall. He did not realize the mortar was so new that the wall could be pulled down by hand. He had been fooled. Jack enjoyed a small moment of triumph. Then the attackers were at the walls. The townspeople shot wildly, and a hail of hasty arrows raked the horsemen. Despite their poor aim, they could not fail to claim some victims. The horses reached the ditch. Some balked, and some charged down into the dip and up the other side. Immediately opposite Jack's position, a huge man in battered chainmail jumped his horse across the ditch so that it landed on the lower slope of the rampart and kept coming up. Jack loaded his sling and let fly. His aim was as good as ever. The stone hit the horse full on the end of its nose. Already floundering in the loose earth, it whinnied in pain, reared up and turned around. It cantered away, but its rider slid off and drew his sword. Most of the horses had turned back, either of their own volition or because their riders had turned them. But several men were attacking on foot, and the others were turning again, ready to make another charge. Glancing back over his shoulder, Jack saw that several thatched roofs were burning, despite the efforts of the firefighters, the younger women of the town, to put out the flames. The dreadful thought flashed through Jack's mind that this was not going to work. Despite the heroic effort of the last 36 hours, these savage men would cross the wall, burn the town, and ravage the people. The prospect of hand-to-hand fighting terrified him. He had never been taught to fight, never used a sword, not that he had one. And his only experience of fighting was when Alfred had beaten him up. He felt helpless. The horsemen charged again, and those of the attackers who had lost their mounts came up the ramparts on foot. Rocks and arrows rained on them. Jack worked his sling systematically, loading and firing like a machine. Several of the attackers fell under the rain of missiles. Right in front of Jack, a rider took a fall and lost his helmet, revealing a head of yellow hair. It was William himself. None of the horses made it to the top of the earth rampart, but some of the men on foot did, and to Jack's horror, the townsmen were forced to join combat with them, fighting off the swords and lances of the attackers with poles and axes. Some of the enemy made it over the top, and Jack saw 3 or 4 townsmen near him fall. His heart was full of horror. The townspeople were losing. But 8 or 10 townsmen surrounded every attacker who got across the wall, pounding them with sticks and hacking mercilessly with axes, and although several townsmen were wounded, all the attackers were killed rapidly. Then the townsmen began to drive the others back down the slope of the ramparts. The charge petered out. Those attackers still on horseback milled around uncertainly, while a few loose skirmishes continued on the ramparts. Jack rested for a moment, breathing hard, grateful for the reprieve, waiting with dread for the enemy's next move. William raised his sword in the air and yelled to attract the attention of his men. He waved his sword in a circle to rally them, then pointed it at the walls. They regrouped and prepared to charge the walls once again. Jack saw an opportunity. He picked up a stone, loaded his sling, and took careful aim at William. The stone flew through the air as straight as a mason's line and hit William in the middle of the forehead, so hard that Jack heard the thud of rock on bone. William fell to the ground. His men hesitated uncertainly, and the charge faltered. A big, dark man jumped from his horse and ran to William's side. Jack thought he recognized William's groom, Walter, who always rode with him. Still holding on to his reins, Walter knelt down by William's prone body. For a moment, Jack hoped William might be dead. Then William moved, and Walter helped him to his feet. William was looking dazed. Everyone on both sides of the battle was watching the two of them. For a moment, The hail of stones and arrows stopped. Still looking unsteady, William mounted Walter's horse, assisted by Walter, who then climbed on behind him. There was a moment of hesitation as everyone wondered whether William would be able to carry on. Walter waved his sword in a circle in the rallying gesture. Then, to Jack's unspeakable relief, he pointed to the woods. Walter kicked the horse and they charged off. The other horsemen followed. Those who were still fighting on the ramparts gave up, backed off, and ran across the field after their leader. A few stones and arrows chased them over the barley. The townspeople cheered. Jack looked around him, feeling dazed. Was it all over? He could hardly believe it. The fires were going out. The women had succeeded in keeping them under control. Men were dancing on the ramparts, hugging one another. Richard came up to him and clapped him on the back. "It was the war that did it, Jack," he said. "Your war." Townspeople and monks crowded around the two of them, all waiting to congratulate Jack and each other. "Have they gone for good?" Jack said. "Oh, yes," Richard replied. "They won't come back now that they've discovered we're determined to defend the walls. William knows that you can't take a walled town if the people are resolved to resist you, not without a vast army and a 6-month siege." "So it's over," Jack said stupidly. Aliena came pushing through the crowd with Tommy in her arms. Jack embraced her gratefully. They were alive and they were together, and he was thankful. He suddenly felt the effect of his 2 days without sleep, and he wanted to lie down. But it was not to be. 2 young masons grabbed him and lifted him onto their shoulders. A cheer went up. They moved off, taking the crowd with them. Jack wanted to tell them that it was not he who had saved them. They had done it themselves. But he knew they would not listen, for they wanted a hero. As the news spread and the whole town realized they had won, the cheering became thunderous. "They've been living in fear of William for years," Jack thought, "but today they've won their freedom." He was carried around the town in a triumphal procession, waving and smiling and longing for the moment when he could lay his head down and close his eyes in blissful sleep. 3. The Shiring Fleece Fair was bigger and better than ever. The square in front of the parish church, where they held markets and executions as well as the annual fair, was crammed with stalls and people. Wool was the main commodity, but there were also displays of everything else that could be bought and sold in England. Gleaming new swords, decoratively carved saddles, fat piglets, red boots, ginger cakes, and straw hats. As William strolled around the square with Bishop Walleran, he calculated that the market was going to make more money for him than ever before, yet it gave him no pleasure. He was still sick with humiliation after his defeat at Kingsbridge. He had expected to charge in unopposed and burn the town, but in the event he had lost men and horses and had been turned back without achieving anything. Worst of all, he knew that the building of the wall had been organized by Jack Jackson, the lover of Aliena, the very man he had wanted to kill. He had failed to kill Jack, but he was still determined to take his revenge. Walleran was also thinking about Kingsbridge, and he said, "I still don't know how they built the wall so quickly." "It probably wasn't much of a wall," William said. Walleran nodded. "But I'm sure Prior Philip is already busy improving it. If I were he, I'd make the wall stronger and higher, build a barbican, and appoint a night watchman. Your days of raiding Kingsbridge are over." William agreed, but he pretended not to. "I can still besiege the town." "That's a different affair. A quick raid may be overlooked by the king. A prolonged siege, during which the townspeople can send a message to the king begging him to protect them, it can be awkward." "Stephen won't move against me," William said. "He needs me." He was not arguing out of conviction, however. In the end, he planned to concede the bishop's point. But he wanted to make Walleran work hard for it, so that he would feel under a small obligation to William. Then William would make the request that was so heavily on his mind. A thin, ugly woman stepped out, pushing in front of her a pretty girl of about 13 years, presumably her daughter. The mother pulled aside the top of the girl's flimsy dress to show her small, immature breasts. 60 pence, the mother hissed. William felt a stirring in his loins, but he shook his head in refusal and brushed past. The child whore made him think of Aliena. She had been little more than a child when he had ravished her. That was almost a decade ago. But he could not forget her. Perhaps he would never have her for himself now, but he could still stop anyone else from having her. Walleran was thoughtful. He hardly seemed to look where he was going, but people shrank back out of his way as if they were afraid even to be touched by the skirts of his black robe. After a moment he said, "Did you hear that the king took Faringdon?" "I was there. It had been the most decisive victory of the entire long civil war. Stephen had captured hundreds of knights and a great armory, and driven Robert of Gloucester all the way back to the West Country. So crucial was the victory that Ranulph of Chester, Stephen's old enemy in the north, had laid down his arms and sworn allegiance to the king. Walleran said, "Now that Stephen is more secure, he won't be so tolerant of his barons waging their own private wars." "Perhaps," William said. He wondered if this was the moment to agree with Walleran and make his request. He hesitated. He was embarrassed. In making the request, he was going to reveal something of his soul, and he hated to do that to a man as ruthless as Bishop Walleran.
"You should leave Kingsbridge alone, at least for a while," Walleran went on. "You've got the Fleece Fair, you still have a weekly market, albeit smaller than it once was. You have the wool business, and you've got all the most fertile land in the county, either directly under your control or farmed by your tenants. My situation is also better than it used to be. I've improved my property and rationalized my holdings. I've built my castle. It's becoming less necessary to fight with Prior Philip, at the very moment when it's becoming politically dangerous." All over the market square, people were making and selling food, and the air was full of smells. Spicy soup, new bread, sugar confections, boiled ham, frying bacon, apple pie. William felt nauseated. "Let's go to the castle," he said. The two men left the market square and walked up the hill. The sheriff was going to give them dinner. At the castle gate, William stopped. "Perhaps you're right about Kingsbridge," he said. "I'm glad you see it. But I still want my revenge on Jack Jackson, and you can give it to me if you will." Walleran raised an eloquent eyebrow. His expression said he was fascinated to listen, but did not consider himself under any obligation. William ploughed on. "Aliena has applied to have her marriage annulled."
"Yes, I know."
"What do you think will be the outcome?"
"Apparently the marriage was never consummated."
"Is that all there is to it?"
"Probably."
"According to Gratian, a learned man whom I have met myself, actually, what constitutes a marriage is the mutual consent of the two parties, but he also maintains that the act of physical union completes or perfects the marriage. He specifically says that if a man marries a woman but does not copulate with her, then marries a second woman with whom he does copulate, then it is the second of the two marriages that is valid, that is to say, the consummated one. The fascinating Aliena will no doubt have mentioned this in her application, if she had sound advice, which I imagine she got from Prior Philip." William was impatient of all this theory. "So they will get the annulment. Unless someone brings up the argument against Gratian. In fact, there are two, one theological and one practical. The theological argument is that Gratian's definition denigrates the marriage of Joseph and Mary, since it was unconsummated. The practical argument is that for political reasons, or to amalgamate two properties, marriages are quite commonly arranged between two children who are physically incapable of consummation. If either bride or groom should die before puberty, the marriage would be invalidated under Gratian's definition, and that could have very awkward consequences." William could never follow these convoluted clerical wrangles, but he had a pretty good idea of how they were settled. "What you mean is it could go either way?"
"Yes."
"And which way it goes depends on who is putting pressure on."
"Yes. In this case, there's nothing hanging on the outcome. No property, no question of allegiance, no military alliance. But if there were more at stake, and someone, an archdeacon, for example, were to put the argument against Gratian forcefully, they would probably refuse the annulment."
Walleran gave William a knowing look that made William want to squirm.
I think I can guess what you're going to ask me next.
I want you to oppose the annulment. Walleran narrowed his eyes.
I can't make out whether you love that wretched woman, or hate her.
No, William said, nor can I. Aliena sat on the grass in the green gloom beneath the mighty beech tree. The waterfall cast droplets like tears onto the rocks at her feet. This was the glade where Jack had told her all those stories. This was where he had given her that first kiss, so casually and quickly that she had pretended that it had never happened. This was where she had fallen in love with him and refused to admit it even to herself. Now she wished with all her heart that she had given herself to him then, and married him and had his babies, so that now, whatever else intervened, she would be his wife. She lay down to rest her aching back. It was the height of summer, and the air was hot and still. This pregnancy was so heavy, and she still had at least 6 weeks to go. She thought she might be carrying twins, except that she felt kicking in only one place, and when Martha, Jack's stepsister, had listened with her ear right up against Aliena's belly, she had heard only one heartbeat. Martha was looking after Tommy this Sunday afternoon, so that Aliena and Jack could meet in the woods and be alone for a while to talk about their future. The Archbishop had refused the annulment, apparently because Bishop Walleran had objected. Philip said they could apply again, but they must live apart meanwhile. Philip agreed that it was unjust, but he said it must be God's will. It seemed more like ill will to Aliena. The bitterness of regret was a weight she carried around with her, like the pregnancy. Sometimes she was more aware of it, sometimes she almost forgot about it, but it was always there. Often it hurt, but it was a familiar pain. She regretted hurting Jack. She regretted what she had done to herself. She even regretted the suffering of the contemptible Alfred, who now lived in Shiring and never showed his face in Kingsbridge. She had married Alfred for one reason only, to support Richard in his attempt to win the earldom. She had failed to achieve her purpose, and her true love for Jack had been blighted. She was 26 years old, her life was ruined, and it was her own fault. She thought nostalgically of those early days with Jack. When she first met him, he had been just a little boy, albeit an unusual one. After he grew up, she had continued to think of him as a boy. That was why he had got under her guard. She had turned away every suitor, but she had not thought of Jack as a suitor, and so she had let him get to know her. She wondered why she had been so resistant to love. She adored Jack, and there was no pleasure in life like the joy of lying with him. Yet once upon a time she had deliberately closed her eyes to such happiness. When she looked back, her life before Jack seemed empty. She had been frantically busy building up her wool business, but now those busy days appeared joyless like an empty palace, or a table laden with silver plates and gold cups, but no food. She heard footsteps and sat up quickly. It was Jack. He was thin and graceful like a scrawny cat. He sat beside her and kissed her mouth softly. He smelled of perspiration and stone dust. "It's so hot," he said. "Let's bathe in the stream." The temptation was irresistible. Jack pulled off his clothes. She watched, staring at him hungrily. She had not seen his naked body for months. He had a lot of red hair on his legs, but none on his chest. He looked at her, waiting for her to strip. She felt shy. He had never seen her body when she was pregnant. She unlaced the neck of her linen dress slowly, then pulled it off over her head. She watched his expression anxiously, afraid he would hate her swollen body, but he showed no revulsion. On the contrary, the look that came over his face was one of fondness. "I should have known better," she thought. "I should have known he would love me just as much." With a swift movement, he knelt on the ground in front of her and kissed the taut skin of her distended belly. She gave an embarrassed laugh. He touched her navel. "Your belly button sticks out," he said. "I knew you were going to say that. It used to be like a dimple. Now it's like a nipple." She felt shy. "Let's bathe," she said. she would feel less self-conscious in the water. The pool by the waterfall was about 3 feet deep. Aliena slid into the water. It was deliciously cool on her hot skin, and she shivered with delight. Jack got in beside her. There was no room to swim, the pool was only a few feet across. He put his head under the waterfall and washed the stone dust out of his hair. Aliena felt good in the water. It relieved the weight of her pregnancy. She ducked her head under the surface to wash her hair. When she came up for air, Jack kissed her. She spluttered and laughed, breathless, rubbing the water out of her eyes. He kissed her again. She put out her arms to hold herself steady, and her hands closed on the hard rod standing upright between Jack's loins like a flagpole. She gasped with pleasure. "I've missed this," Jack said in her ear, and his voice was hoarse with lust and some other emotion, sadness, perhaps. Aliena's throat was dry with desire. She said, "Are we going to break our promise?" "Now and forevermore."
"What do you mean?"
"We're not going to live apart. We're leaving Kingsbridge."
"But what will you do?"
"Go to a different town and build another cathedral."
"But you won't be master. It won't be your design."
"One day I may get another chance.
I'm young."
It was possible, but the odds were against it, Aliena knew, and Jack knew it too. The sacrifice he was making for her moved her to tears. Nobody had ever loved her like this. Nobody else ever would. But she was not willing to let him give up everything.
"I won't do it," she said.
"What do you mean?"
"I'm not going to leave Kingsbridge."
He was angry. "Why not? Anywhere else we can live as man and wife, and nobody will care. We could even get married in a church." She touched his face.
"I love you too much to take you away from Kingsbridge Cathedral."
"That's for me to decide."
"Jack, I love you for offering. The fact that you're ready to give up your life's work to live with me is... it almost breaks my heart that you should love me so much.
But I don't want to be the woman who took you away from the work you loved. I'm not willing to go with you that way. It will cast a shadow over our entire lives. You may forgive me for it, but I never will." Jack looked sad. "I know better than to fight you once you've decided.
But what will we do? We'll try again for the annulment. We'll live apart."
He looked miserable. She finished, "And we'll come here every Sunday and break our promise." He pressed up against her, and she could feel him becoming aroused again.
"Every Sunday?"
"Yes."
"You might get pregnant again."
"We'll take that chance, and I'm going to start manufacturing cloth as I used to. I've bought Philip's unsold wool again, and I'm going to organize the townspeople to spin and weave it. Then I'll felt it in the fulling mill."
"How did you pay Philip?"
Jack said in surprise.
"I haven't yet. I'm going to pay him in bales of cloth when it's made."
Jack nodded. He said bitterly, "He agreed to that because he wants you to stay here so that I'll stay." Aliena nodded. "But he'll still get cheap cloth out of it."
"Damn Philip. He always gets what he wants."
Aliena saw that she had won. She kissed him and said, "I love you." He kissed her back, running his hands all over her body, greedily feeling her secret places. Then he stopped and said, "But I want to be with you every night, not just on Sundays." She kissed his ear.
"One day we will," she breathed. "I promise you."
He moved behind her, drifting in the water, and pulled her to him so that his legs were underneath her. She parted her thighs and floated down gently into his lap. He stroked her full breasts with his hands and played with her swollen nipples. Finally he penetrated her, and she shuddered with pleasure. They made love slowly and gently in the cool pond, with the rush of the waterfall in their ears. Jack put his arms around her bump, and his knowing hands touched her between her legs, pressing and stroking as he went in and out. They had never done this before, made love this way, so that he could caress her most sensitive places at the same time, and it was sharply different, a more intense pleasure, different the way a stabbing pain is different from a dull ache, but perhaps that was because she felt so sad. After a while, she abandoned herself to the sensation. its intensity built up so quickly that the climax took her by surprise, almost frightening her, and she was racked by spasms of pleasure so convulsive that she screamed. He stayed inside her, hard, unsatisfied, while she caught her breath. He was still, no longer thrusting, but she realized he had not reached a climax. After a while she began to move again, encouragingly, but he did not respond. She turned her head and kissed him over her shoulder. The water on his face was warm. He was weeping. Part 5, 1152 to 1155. Chapter 14. After 7 years, Jack had finished the transepts, the two arms of the cross-shaped church, and they were everything he had hoped for. He had improved on the ideas of Saint-Denis, making everything taller and narrower, windows, arches, and the vault itself. The clustered shafts of the piers rose gracefully through the gallery and became the ribs of the vault, curving over to meet in the middle of the ceiling, and the tall pointed windows flooded the interior with light. The mouldings were fine and delicate, and the carved decoration was a riot of stone foliage. And there were cracks in the clerestory. He stood in the high clerestory passage, staring out across the chasm of the north transept, brooding on a bright spring morning. He was shocked and baffled. By all the wisdom of the masons, the structure was strong, but a crack showed a weakness. His vault was higher than any other he had ever seen, but not by that much. He had not made the mistake of Alfred and put a stone vault on a structure that was not built to take the weight. His walls had been designed for a stone vault. Yet cracks had appeared in his clerestory in roughly the same place where Alfred's had failed. Alfred had miscalculated, but Jack was sure he had not done the same thing. Some new factor was operating in Jack's building, and he did not know what it was. It was not dangerous, not in the short term. The cracks had been filled with mortar, and they had not yet reappeared. The building was safe, but it was weak, and for Jack the weakness spoiled it. He wanted his church to last until the day of judgment. He left the clerestory and went down the turret staircase to the gallery, where he had made his tracing floor, in the corner where there was a good light from one of the windows in the north porch. He began to draw the plinth of a nave pier. He drew a diamond, then a square inside the diamond, then a circle inside the square. The main shafts of the pier would spring from the four points of the diamond and rise up the column, eventually branching off north, south, east, and west to become arches or ribs. Subsidiary shafts, springing from the corners of the square, would rise to become vaulting ribs, going diagonally across the nave vault on one side and the aisle vault on the other. The circle in the middle represented the core of the pier. All Jack's designs were based on simple geometrical shapes and some not so simple proportions, such as the ratio of the square root of 2 to the square root of 3. Jack had learned how to figure square roots in Toledo, but most masons could not calculate them, and instead used simple geometric constructions. They knew that if a circle was drawn around the four corners of a square, the diameter of the circle was bigger than the side of the square in the ratio of the square root of 2 to 1. The ratio, root 2 to 1, was the most ancient of the masons' formulas. For in a simple building it was the ratio of the outside width to the inside width, and therefore gave the thickness of the wall. Jack's task was much complicated by the religious significance of various numbers. Prior Philip was planning to rededicate the church to the Virgin Mary, because the Weeping Madonna worked more miracles than the tomb of St. Adolphus, and in consequence they wanted Jack to use the numbers 9 and 7, which were Mary's numbers. He had designed the nave with 9 bays, and the new chancel, to be built when all else was finished, with 7. The interlocked blind arcading in the side aisles would have 7 arches per bay, and the west facade would have 9 lancet windows. Jack had no opinion about the theological significance of numbers, but he felt instinctively that if the same numbers were used fairly consistently, it was bound to add to the harmony of the finished building. Before he could finish his drawing of the plinth, he was interrupted by the master roofer, who had hit a problem and wanted Jack to solve it. Jack followed the man up the turret staircase, past the clerestory, and into the roof space. They walked across the rounded domes that were the top side of the ribbed vault. Above them, the roofers were unrolling great sheets of lead and nailing them to the rafters, starting at the bottom and working up so that the upper sheets would overlap the lower and keep the rain out. Jack saw the problem immediately. He had put a decorative pinnacle at the end of a valley between two sloping roofs, but he had left the design to a master mason, and the mason had not made provision for rainwater from the roof to pass through or under the pinnacle. The mason would have to alter it. He told the master roofer to pass this instruction on to the mason, then he returned to his tracing floor. He was astonished to find Alfred waiting for him there. He had not spoken to Alfred for 10 years. He had seen him at a distance now and again in Shiring or Winchester. Aliena had not so much as caught sight of him for 9 years, even though they were still married according to the church. Martha went to visit him at his house in Shiring about once a year. She always brought back the same report. He was prospering, building houses for the burghers of Shiring. He lived alone. He was the same as ever. But Alfred did not appear prosperous now. Jack thought he looked tired and defeated. Alfred had always been big and strong, but now he had a lean look. His face was thinner, and the hand with which he pushed the hair out of his eyes was bony, where it had once been beefy. He said, "Hello, Jack?" His expression was aggressive, but his tone of voice was ingratiating, an unattractive mixture. "Hello, Alfred," Jack said warily. "Last time I saw you, you were wearing a silk tunic and running to fat. That was 3 years ago, before the first of the bad harvests." So it was. 3 bad harvests in a row had caused a famine. Serfs had starved. Many tenant farmers were destitute, and presumably the burghers of Shiring could no longer afford splendid new stone houses. Alfred was feeling the pinch. Jack said, "What brings you to Kingsbridge after all this time?" "I heard about your transepts and came to look." His tone was one of grudging admiration. "Where did you learn to build like this?" "Paris," Jack said shortly. He did not want to discuss that period of his life with Alfred, who had been the cause of his exile. "Well?" Alfred looked awkward, then said with elaborate indifference, "I'd be willing to work here, just to pick up some of these new tricks." Jack was flabbergasted. Did Alfred really have the nerve to ask him for a job? Playing for time, he said, "What about your gang?" "I'm on my own now," Alfred said, still trying to be casual. "There wasn't enough work for a gang." "We're not hiring anyway," Jack said equally casually. "We've got a full complement." "But you can always use a good mason, can't you?" Jack heard a faint pleading note and realized that Alfred was desperate. He decided to be honest. "After the life we've had, Alfred, I'm the last person you should come to for help." "You are the last," Alfred said candidly. "I've tried everywhere. Nobody's hiring. It's the famine." Jack thought of all the times Alfred had mistreated him, tormented him, and beaten him. Alfred had driven him into the monastery, and then had driven him away from his home and family. He had no reason to help Alfred. Indeed, he had cause to gloat over Alfred's misfortune. He said, "I wouldn't take you on, even if I was needing men." "I thought you might," Alfred said with bull-headed persistence. "After all, my father taught you everything you know. It's because of him that you're a master builder. Won't you help me for his sake?" "For Tom." Suddenly Jack felt a twinge of conscience. In his own way, Tom had tried to be a good stepfather. He had not been gentle or understanding, but he had treated his own children much the same as Jack, and he had been patient and generous in passing on his knowledge and skills. He had also made Jack's mother happy most of the time, and after all, Jack thought, here I am, a successful and prosperous master builder, well on the way to achieving my ambition of building the most beautiful cathedral in the world. And there's Alfred, poor and hungry and out of work. Isn't that revenge enough? No, it's not, he thought. Then he relented. All right, he said. For Tom's sake, you're hired. Thank you, Alfred said. His expression was unreadable. Shall I start right away? Jack nodded. We're laying foundations in the nave. Just join in. Alfred held out his hand. Jack hesitated momentarily, then shook it. Alfred's grip was as strong as ever. Alfred disappeared. Jack stood staring down at his drawing of a nave plinth. It was life-size, so that when it was finished a master carpenter could make a wooden template directly from the drawing. The template would then be used by the masons to mark the stones for carving. Had he made the right decision? He recalled that Alfred's vaults had collapsed. However, he would not use Alfred on difficult work such as vaulting or arches. Straightforward walls and floors were his métier. While Jack was still pondering, the noon bell rang for dinner. He put down his sharpened wire drawing instrument and went down the turret staircase to ground level. The married masons went home to dinner, and the single ones ate in the lodge. On some building sites, dinner was provided as a way of preventing afternoon lateness, absenteeism, and drunkenness, but monks' fare was often spartan, and most building workers preferred to provide their own. Jack was living in Tom Builder's old house with Martha, his stepsister, who acted as his housekeeper. Martha also minded Tommy and Jack's second child, a girl whom they had named Sally, while Aliena was busy. Martha usually made dinner for Jack and the children, and Aliena sometimes joined them. He left the priory close and walked briskly home. On the way, a thought struck him. Would Alfred expect to move back into the house with Martha? She was his natural sister, after all. Jack had not thought of that when he gave Alfred the job. It was a foolish fear, he decided a moment later. The days when Alfred could bully him were long past. He was the master builder of Kingsbridge, and if he said Alfred could not move into the house, then Alfred would not move into the house. He half expected to find Alfred at the kitchen table, and was relieved to find he was not. Aliena was watching the children eat while Martha stirred a pot on the fire. The smell of lamb's stew was mouth-watering. He kissed Aliena's forehead briefly. She was 33 years old now, but she looked as she had 10 years ago. Her hair was still a rich dark brown mass of curls, and she had the same generous mouth and fine dark eyes. Only when she was naked did she show the physical effects of time and childbirth. Her marvelous deep breasts were lower, her hips were broader, and her belly had never reverted to its original taut flatness. Jack looked affectionately at the two offspring of Aliena's body. 9-year-old Tommy, a healthy red-haired boy, big for his age, shoveling lamb's stew into his mouth as if he had not eaten for a week, and Sally, age 7, with dark curls like her mother's, smiling happily and showing a gap between her front teeth, just like the one Martha had had when Jack first saw her 17 years ago. Tommy went to the school in the priory every morning to learn to read and write, but the monks would not take girls, so Aliena was teaching Sally. Jack sat down, and Martha took the pot off the fire and set it on the table. Martha was a strange girl. She was past 20 years old, but she showed no interest in getting married. She had always been attached to Jack, and now she seemed perfectly content to be his housekeeper. Jack presided over the oddest household in the county, without a doubt. He and Aliena were two of the leading citizens of the town, he the master builder of the cathedral, and she the largest manufacturer of cloth outside Winchester. Everyone treated them as man and wife, yet they were forbidden to spend nights together, and they lived in separate houses, Aliena with her brother, and Jack with his stepsister. Every Sunday afternoon, and on every holiday, they would disappear, and everyone knew what they were doing, except, of course, Prior Philip. Meanwhile, Jack's mother lived in a cave in the forest because she was supposed to be a witch. Every now and again Jack got angry about not being allowed to marry Aliena. He would lie awake, listening to Martha snoring in the next room, and think, "I'm 28 years old. Why am I sleeping alone?" The next day he would be bad-tempered with Prior Philip, rejecting all the chapter's suggestions and requests as impracticable or over-expensive, refusing to discuss alternatives or compromises, as if there were only one way to build a cathedral, and that was Jack's way. Then Philip would steer clear of him for a few days and let the storm blow over. Aliena, too, was unhappy, and she took it out on Jack. She would become impatient and intolerant, criticizing everything he did, putting the children to bed as soon as he came in, saying she was not hungry when he ate. After a day or two of this mood, she would burst into tears and say she was sorry, and they would be happy again, until the next time the strain became too much for her. Jack ladled some stew into a bowl and began to eat.
"Guess who came to the site this morning?" he said.
"Alfred."
Martha dropped an iron pot lid on the hearthstone with a loud clang.
Jack looked at her and saw fear on her face. He turned to Aliena and saw that she had turned white.
Aliena said, "What's he doing in Kingsbridge?"
"Looking for work. The famine has impoverished the merchants of Shiring, I guess, and they aren't building stone houses like they used to. He's dismissed his gang and he can't find work."
"I hope you threw him out on his tail," Aliena said.
"He said I should give him a job for Tom's sake," Jack said nervously. He had not anticipated such a strong reaction from the two women. "After all, I owe everything to Tom."
"Cow shit!" Aliena said,
and Jack thought, "She got that expression from my mother." "Well, I hired him anyway," he said.
"Jack!" Aliena screamed. "How could you? You can't let him come back to Kingsbridge, that devil!"
Sally began to cry. Tommy stared wide-eyed at his mother. Jack said, "Alfred isn't a devil. He's hungry and penniless. I saved him for the sake of his father's memory."
"You wouldn't feel sorry for him if he'd forced you to sleep on the floor at the foot of his bed like a dog for 9 months."
"He's done worse things to me," asked Martha.
Martha said, "And to me."
Jack said, "I just decided that seeing him like that was enough revenge for me."
"Well, it's not enough for me," Aliena stormed. "By Christ, you're a damned fool, Jack Jackson. Sometimes I thank God I'm not married to you."
That hurt. Jack looked away. He knew she did not mean it, but it was bad enough that she should say it, even in anger. He picked up his spoon and started to eat. It was hard to swallow. Aliena patted Sally's head and put a piece of carrot into her mouth. Sally stopped crying. Jack looked at Tommy, who was still staring at Aliena with a frightened face.
"Eat, Tommy," said Jack. "It's good."
They finished their dinner in silence. In the spring of the year that the transepts were finished, Prior Philip made a tour of the monastery's property in the south. After 3 bad years, he needed a good harvest, and he wanted to check what state the farms were in. He took Jonathan with him. The priory orphan was now a tall, awkward, intelligent 16-year-old. Like Philip at that age, he did not seem to suffer a moment's doubt about what he wanted to do with his life. He had completed his novitiate and taken his vows, and he was now Brother Jonathan. Also like Philip, he was interested in the material side of God's service, and he worked as deputy to Cuthbert Whitehead, the aging cellarer. Philip was proud of the boy. He was devout, hard-working, and well-liked. Their escort was Richard, the brother of Aliena. Richard had at last found his niche in Kingsbridge. After they built the town wall, Philip had suggested to the parish guild that they appoint Richard as head of the watch, responsible for the town's security. He organized the night watchman and arranged for the maintenance and improvement of the town walls, and on market days and holy days, he was empowered to arrest troublemakers and drunks. These tasks, which had become essential as the village had grown into a town, were all things a monk was not supposed to do. So the parish guild, which Philip had at first seen as a threat to his authority, had turned out to be useful after all. And Richard was happy. He was about 30 years old now, but the active life he led kept him looking young. Philip wished Richard's sister could be as settled. If ever a person had been failed by the church, it was Aliena. Jack was the man she loved and the father of her children, but the church insisted that she was married to Alfred, even though she had never had carnal knowledge of him, and she was unable to get an annulment because of the ill will of the bishop. It was shameful, and Philip felt guilty, even though he was not responsible. Toward the end of the trip, when they were riding home through the forest on a bright spring morning, young Jonathan said, "I wonder why God makes people starve." It was a question every young monk asked sooner or later, and there were lots of answers to it. Philip said, "Don't blame this famine on God." "But God made the weather that caused the bad harvests." "The famine is not just due to bad harvests," Philip said. "There are always bad harvests every few years, but people don't starve. What's special about this crisis is that it comes after so many years of civil war. Why does that make a difference? Jonathan asked. Richard, the soldier, answered him, War is bad for farming, he said. Livestock get slaughtered to feed the armies, crops are burned to deny them to the enemy, and farms are neglected while knights go to war. Philip added, And when the future is uncertain, people are not willing to invest time and energy clearing new ground, increasing herds, digging ditches, and building barns. We haven't stopped doing that sort of work, Jonathan said. Monasteries are different. But most ordinary farmers let their farms run down during the fighting, so that when the bad weather came, they were not in good shape to ride it out. Monks take a longer view. But we have another problem. The price of wool has slumped because of the famine. I don't see the connection, Jonathan said. I suppose it's because starving people don't buy clothes. It was the first time in Philip's memory that the price of wool had failed to go up annually. He had been forced to slow the pace of cathedral building, stop taking new novices, and eliminate wine and meat from the monk's diet. Unfortunately, it means that we're economizing just when more and more destitute people are coming to Kingsbridge looking for work. Jonathan said, And so they end up queuing at the Priory Gate for free horse bread and pottage. Philip nodded grimly. It broke his heart to see strong men reduced to begging for bread because they could find no work. But remember, it's caused by war, not bad weather, he said. With youthful passion, Jonathan said, I hope there's a special place in hell for the earls and kings who cause such misery. I hope so. Saints preserve us, what's that? A strange figure had burst from the undergrowth and was running full tilt at Philip. His clothes were ragged, his hair was wild, and his face was black with dirt. Philip thought the poor man must be running away from an enraged boar, or even an escaped bear. Then the man ran up and threw himself on Philip. Philip was so surprised that he fell off his horse. His attacker fell on top of him. The man smelled like an animal and sounded like one, too. He made a constant, inarticulate grunting noise. Philip wriggled and kicked. The man seemed to be trying to get hold of the leather satchel that Philip had slung over his shoulder. Philip realized the man was trying to rob him. There was nothing in the satchel but a book, The Song of Solomon. Philip struggled desperately to get free, not because he was specially attached to the book, but because the robber was so disgustingly dirty. But Philip was tangled up in the strap of the satchel, and the robber would not let go. They rolled over on the hard ground, Philip trying to get away and the robber trying to keep hold of the satchel. Philip was vaguely aware that his horse had bolted. Suddenly the robber was jerked away by Richard. Philip rolled over and sat upright, but he did not get to his feet for a moment. He was dazed and winded. He breathed the clean air, relieved to be free of the robber's noxious embrace. He felt his bruises. Nothing was broken. He turned his attention to the others. Richard had the robber flat on the ground, and was standing over him, with one foot between the man's shoulder blades and the point of his sword touching the back of the man's neck. Jonathan was holding the two remaining horses and looking bewildered. Philip got gingerly to his feet, feeling weak. When I was Jonathan's age, he thought, I could fall off a horse and jump right back on again. Richard said, If you keep an eye on this cockroach, I'll catch your horse. He offered Philip his sword. All right, Philip said. He waved the sword away. I shan't need that. Richard hesitated, then sheathed his sword. The robber lay still. The legs, sticking out from under his tunic, were as thin as twigs and the same color, and he was barefoot. Philip had never been in any serious danger. This poor man was too weak to strangle a chicken. Richard walked off after Philip's horse. The robber saw Richard go and tensed. Philip knew the man was about to make a break for it. He stopped him by saying, Would you like something to eat? The robber raised his head and looked at Philip as if he thought Philip was mad. Philip went to Jonathan's horse and opened a saddlebag. He took out a loaf, broke it, and offered half to the robber. The man grabbed it unbelievingly and immediately stuffed most of it into his mouth. Philip sat on the ground and watched him. The man ate like an animal, trying to swallow as much as possible before the meal could be snatched from him. At first, Philip had thought he was an old man, but now that he could see him better, he realized that the thief was quite young, perhaps 25. Richard came back leading Philip's horse. He was indignant when he saw the robber sitting eating. "Why have you given him our food?" he said to Philip. "Because he's starving," Philip said. Richard did not reply, but his expression said that monks were mad. When the robber had eaten the bread, Philip said, "What's your name?" The man looked wary. He hesitated. Philip somehow got the idea that the man had not spoken to another human being for a while. At last he said, "David." He still had his sanity, anyway, Philip thought. He said, "What happened to you, David?"
"I lost my farm after the last harvest."
"Who was your landlord?"
"The Earl of Shiring."
"William Hamley." Philip was not surprised. Thousands of tenant farmers had been unable to pay their rents after three bad harvests. When Philip's tenants defaulted, he simply forgave the rent, since if he made people destitute, they would just come to the priory for charity anyway. Other landlords, notably Earl William, took advantage of the crisis to evict tenants and repossess their farms. The result was a huge increase in the number of outlaws living in the forest and preying on travellers. That was why Philip had to take Richard everywhere with him, as bodyguard.
"What about your family?" Philip asked the robber. "My wife took the baby and went back to her mother. But there was no room for me."
It was a familiar story. Philip said, "It's a sin to lay hands on a monk, David, and it's wrong to live by theft." "But how shall I live?" the man cried. "If you're going to stay in the forest, you'd better catch birds and fish."
"I don't know how."
"You're a failure as a robber," Philip said. "What chance of success did you have with no weapon up against three of us, and Richard here armed to the teeth?"
"I was desperate."
"Well, next time you're desperate, go to a monastery. There's always something for a poor man to eat." Philip got to his feet. The sour taste of hypocrisy was in his mouth. He knew the monasteries could not possibly feed all the outlaws. For most of them, there really was no alternative but theft. But his role in life was to counsel virtuous living, not to make excuses for sin. There was no more he could do for this wretched man. He took the reins of his horse from Richard and climbed into the saddle. He could tell that the bruises from his fall were going to hurt him for days. "Go thy way and sin no more," he said, quoting Jesus. Then he kicked his horse forward.
"You're too good, you are," said Richard as they rode off.
Philip shook his head sadly.
"The real trouble is, I'm not good enough."
On the Sunday before Whitsun, William Hamley got married. It was his mother's idea. Mother had been nagging him for years to find a wife and father an heir, but he had always put it off. Women bored him, and in a way that he did not understand and really did not want to think about, they made him anxious. He kept telling Mother he would marry soon, but he never did anything about it. In the end, she found him a bride. Her name was Elizabeth. She was the daughter of Harold of Weymouth, a wealthy knight and a strong supporter of Stephen. As Mother explained to William, with a little effort he could have made a better match, could have married a daughter of an earl. But as he was not willing to put his mind to it, Elizabeth would do. William had seen her at the King's Court in Winchester, and Mother had noticed him staring at her. She had a pretty face, a mass of light brown curls, a big bust and narrow hips, just William's type. She was 14 years old. When William stared at her, he had been imagining meeting her on a dark night and taking her by force in the back alleys of Winchester. Marriage had not crossed his mind. However, Mother swiftly established that the father was agreeable and the girl herself was an obedient child who would do what she was told. Having reassured William that there would be no repetition of the humiliation Aliena had inflicted on the family, Mother arranged a meeting. William had been nervous. Last time he had done this, he had been an inexperienced youth of 20, the son of a knight, meeting an arrogant young lady of the nobility. But now he was a battle-hardened man, 37 years old, and he had been the Earl of Shiring for 10 years. He was foolish to be nervous about a meeting with a 14-year-old girl. However, she was even more nervous. She was also desperate to please him. She talked excitedly about her home and family, her horses and dogs, and her relations and friends. He sat silently watching her face, imagining what she would look like naked. Bishop Walleran married them in the chapel at Earl's Castle, and there was a big feast that went on for the rest of the day. By custom, everyone of importance in the county had to be invited, and William would have lost face badly if he had not provided a lavish banquet. They roasted 3 whole oxen and dozens of sheep and pigs in the castle compound, and the guests drank the castle cellars dry of beer, cider, and wine. William's mother presided over the festivities with a look of triumph on her disfigured face. Bishop Walleran found vulgar celebration somewhat distasteful, and he left when the bride's uncle began to tell funny stories about newlyweds. The bride and groom retired to their chamber at nightfall, leaving the guests to continue reveling. William had been at enough weddings to know the ideas that were passing through the minds of the younger guests, so he stationed Walter outside the room and barred the door to prevent interruption. Elizabeth took off her tunic and her shoes and stood there in her linen shirt.
"I don't know what to do,"
she said simply.
"You'll have to show me."
This was not quite how William had imagined it. He went over to her. She lifted her face and he kissed her soft lips. Somehow the kiss failed to generate any heat. He said, "Take off your shirt and lie on the bed." She pulled the undershirt over her head. She was quite plump. Her large breasts had tiny indented nipples. A light brown fuzz of hair covered the triangle between her legs. Obediently, she walked to the bed and lay down on her back. William kicked off his boots. He sat on the bed beside her and squeezed her breasts. Her skin was soft. This sweet, obliging, smiling girl was nothing like the image that had made his throat go dry, of a woman in the grip of passion, moaning and sweating beneath him, and he felt cheated. He put his hand between her thighs, and she parted her legs immediately. He pushed his finger inside her. She gasped, hurt, then quickly said,
"It's all right. I don't mind."
He wondered briefly whether he was going about this in completely the wrong way. He had a momentary vision of a different scene in which the two of them lay side by side, touching and talking and getting to know one another gradually. However, desire had at last stirred inside him when she gasped in pain, and he brushed his doubts aside and fingered her more roughly. He watched her face as she struggled to bear the pain silently. He got on the bed and knelt between her legs. He was not fully aroused. He rubbed himself to make his organ stiffer, but it had little effect. It was her damned smile that was making him impotent, he was sure. He pushed 2 fingers inside her, and she gave a little cry of pain. That was better. Then the silly bitch started smiling again. He realized he would have to wipe the smile off her face. He slapped her hard. She cried out, and her lip bled. This was more like it. He hit her again. She started to cry. After that, it was all right. The following Sunday happened to be Whitsunday, when a huge crowd would attend the cathedral. Bishop Walleran would take the service. There would be even more people than usual, because everyone was keen to look at the new transepts, which had recently been finished. Rumour said they were amazing. William would show his bride to the ordinary folk of the county at that service. He had not been to Kingsbridge since they built the wall, but Philip could not stop him from going to church. 2 days before Whitsunday, his mother died. She was about 60 years old. It was quite sudden. She felt breathless after dinner on Friday and went to bed early. Her maid woke William a little before dawn to tell him that his mother was in distress. He got up from his bed and went stumbling into her room, rubbing his face. He found her gasping horribly for breath, unable to speak, a look of terror in her eyes. William was frightened by her great shuddering gasps and her staring eyes. She kept looking at him, as if she expected him to do something. He was so scared he decided to leave the room, and he turned away. Then he saw the maid standing at the door, and he felt ashamed of his fear. He forced himself to look at Mother again.
Her face seemed to change shape continually in the inconstant light of the one candle. Her hoarse, ragged breathing got louder and louder until it seemed to fill his head. He could not understand why it had not woken the whole castle. He put his hands over his ears to shut out the noise, but he could still hear it. It was as if she was shouting at him, the way she had